Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We are live once again, as we are each weekday, for an hour, taking your calls over the air. If you have questions that you want to ask about the Bible or Christianity, or if you have a different view from that of the host, you want to bring those things up for conversation, that's what we do here for the next hour. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Our first caller today is Willie, calling from Green Springs, Ohio. Willie, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve.
Hi. Sure.
I have a couple questions for you. One should be pretty quick. The other one.
Okay, you're not very loud. Are you? You got a bad connection or something? Because it's pretty faint.
I'm not sure. Give me one second.
Yeah, if you're on the speakerphone, that may be the problem.
Is that better?
Oh, that's perfect.
Is that better, maybe? Okay, yeah. Good. All right, yeah, I got a quick question. Okay, so I've went through a lot of your material on your site, and you reference a lot 8070. Is there by chance a series or a set of lectures that would go through the, I guess, importance of AD-70 and why that was such a big deal when you were doing those courses, or is that just kind of a reoccurring theme?
It's a reoccurring theme in Scripture, but when Jesus predicted it many times, Revelation, in my opinion, predicts it. Many of the Old Testament prophets predicted it. It was, of course, the end of the old order. I mean, it's like the most major turning point in history. It's with the passing of the old order and the entrance of the new order of Christianity, the Messiah's kingdom, and so forth. So that transitional period was what all the prophets looked forward to. Actually, when Jesus was talking about it in Luke 21, around verse 20, he said, you know, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, know that its desolation is near. He says, then you who are in Judea flee to the mountains and so forth. These are the days of vengeance, that all things that are written may be fulfilled. So he's basically saying this destruction of Jerusalem was going to be, as it were, fulfillment of all things that were written, and indicating that Old Testament prophecy had a great deal about it that was fulfilled at that time. But as far as my lectures on it, it does come up, of course, going through the prophets. It comes up going through the Olivet Discourse. It comes up in my lectures on Revelation. But there's also a series in the topical lectures at our website called When Shall These Things Be? And especially the lectures there about the tribulation would go into this in some detail.
Okay. Yeah, I've been through When Shall These Things Be? I may have to go through them again. I'm trying to work my way through the prophets, but I appreciate that.
Yeah. I've never just given a lecture just on 70 AD and pulling in.
Yeah,
all
I wasn't sure if you had a cumulative thing.
Right.
So, yeah. My second question, I'm actually in a discussion with an atheist, and we're going through specifically morality. And he had brought up 2 Kings 19:35, I believe, and stating that, you know, God should surely want to set the example for his people. And so why was this instance, you know, why did he perpetuate murder, more or less? And I think I know how I would tackle it, but I was curious as to your input and how that relates to morality, I suppose.
Well, what happened in 2 Kings 19:35 is that God sent an angel out to slay 185,000 of the Assyrians who were encamped around Jerusalem. How is this a problem to him? I mean, God judges the wicked many times in the Bible. That's what a judge has to do. A judge has to decide how the wicked should be punished. And God is the most righteous and just and intelligent and wise judge there ever was. So we have to assume that when he issues a judgment, it's a just one, and it's a deserved one. But these were people who were besieging. It was like an invading army besieging Jerusalem. Jerusalem had done nothing to provoke them. It was just an aggressive, empire that was wanting to annex and conquer Jerusalem. It'd be like, you know, if some hostile nation was attacking us, and if God was on our side, which, of course, we couldn't be sure that he would be in any modern war, but
right.
God was on Jerusalem's side at that time because of King Hezekiah's prayers. God rescued them without them having to fire a shot. I mean, I don't see how that's a bad example of any morality.
Yeah, and that's how I take it, too. I think he's caught up in, maybe God's justice and authority over us and that whole business.
Well, of course.
But yeah,
of course.
I appreciate that.
Many atheists, it's not so much that they don't believe in God, but they resent God. They don't like the idea of God owning us and doing what he wants to do in us and us being loyal to him through it all and recognizing his goodness in it. I mean, they don't want to do any of that. And so they're always looking for things in the Bible that they think are flaws in God's character. But I just need to know, why would an atheist have any complaints about God's morality? Where does morality come from? I mean, what moral standard does the atheist have for judging what God does?
Yeah.
And where does he get that standard?
Yeah. And that's where we're having that discussion, and I'm trying to explain to him, because he completely denies objective morality. He thinks
right.
It's all subjective, in which
exactly,
case,
which
what does it matter?
Yeah, exactly, in which case he can't criticize anything God does on the basis of it being unjust or immoral, since he doesn't believe there is anything, any category of unjust.
Exactly.
He's just making a fool of himself. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, Steve. Well, I appreciate it, brother.
Okay. Thanks for your call. Good talking to you. Peter from London, England. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
My question, are Christians, is conservatism more representative of Christians? Because I've come across a lot of Christians who identify themselves as liberal, and when I hear their views on creation, you know, is whether God, you know, creation creation came about because of the Big Bang or Darwin's theory on evolution or morality in terms of sex before marriage, or even just criticizing whether, you know, stories in the Bible are true. I don't know if when I'm thinking of liberalism, I just think it's anti-Christian. But I don't know if I'm just judging it by its most extreme elements.
Yeah. Now, you're referring to Christian liberalism as opposed to political liberalism. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, because Christian liberalism, it used to be called modernism when it first arose, and it was very popular in Germany in the late 19th century. It crossed over the pond to us, and so we have a lot of liberal seminaries and so forth here, too. Basically, the way I would understand a liberal Christian is one who doesn't have any confidence in the Bible, they'd say they respect the Bible. They just don't believe the Bible tells the truth most of the time. They don't believe Jesus was born of a virgin. They don't believe he rose from the dead. They don't believe the miracles are true. They don't believe the creation story. Certainly don't believe in the flood, or the Tower of Babel, or any of those things. They believe the Bible is full of, you know, moral tales and myths that maybe teach moral lessons, perhaps. But they don't believe it's, first of all, they don't even believe it's true, much less do they consider it to be the Word of God in the sense that a conservative Christian would. A conservative Christian is one who takes the Bible at face value. And when the writers say they were speaking for God and give evidence of it by whether they worked miracles or whether they prophesied events that were to come, and they did. I mean, we consider those people who spoke for God and proved it, put their money where their mouth is, are worthy of being believed. And we wonder, if God did, in fact, speak through people or write through people, what better evidence would we hope for? What could we ask for than the evidence that exists in the form of, first of all, there's historical stories of the Bible are very, very often confirmed by archaeological discoveries. In fact, there was a non-Christian archaeologist, Miller Burroughs, who said that many skeptical archaeologists has had his faith in the Bible improved by his excavations in Palestine. Because again and again, parts of the Bible that were said by skeptics to be untrue were proven to be true by archaeology. Isn't catching up all the way with the Bible yet. The Bible was true before they found out that it was true. But they're learning. Archaeologists have been learning. And as far as it, you know, being true, that's perhaps the most important thing, but also that it's true because God gave it to us and inspired the authors is what conservative Christians believe. So, I think that when someone calls themselves a liberal Christian, but they don't believe Jesus is anything other than an ordinary man, and they don't believe he rose from the dead, And they, you know, then I would have to say that's they lack the essentials of what's called a Christian. You don't have to believe very many things to be a Christian. You know, you can be wrong about a lot of things and still be a Christian, but you have to at least believe in Jesus. If you don't believe in Jesus, then what is left to give you the definition of being a Christian?
Yeah, I agree. And my last question. So I've had some discussions with some friends regarding Christian marriage, and there seems to be sort of two camps where and one that's growing in popularity is the egalitarian view, where both the husband and wife are, you know, there's no hierarchy in that in a marriage where, you know, this idea of the husband being the head of the home. And I even had a friend who doesn't, he's married, and he says that, you know, he thinks head means that, head doesn't mean,
source?
You know, authority.
Source? Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Source. Yeah, correct. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the, I think it's called the complementarian view, which is right. You know, the more traditional view. Is one bit more biblical? I'm of the latter. I think that, is that more biblical? Or,
right.
Again, is
well,
this...
The hierarchical marriage is what God created in the garden. It is what the New Testament teaches. And therefore, it is, you know, the biblical view, both Old and New Testament. Now, there are times when the norm can be abandoned by necessity. For example, there are cases where, say, a man dies or he leaves his wife and she's now, you know, the head of the family. Or where a man is, let's say, disabled. Or he has a brain injury and he can't function. Well, of course, obviously, there are exceptional cases where, you know, the woman would have to step up. But the egalitarian view is the view that there shouldn't be any ideal of hierarchy at all among human beings. And this is a radically democratic position. Of course, we, in ancient times, up till fairly modern times, all nations had kings, and they realized that citizens were subject to kings. But with the advent of modern democracies, even the rulers, the presidents and prime ministers and so forth are subject to the voters, they're subject to the people. So there, we don't have those kinds of absolute authorities in our secular world, not in our part of the world anyway. But when people try to apply the trends in secular society to things that God has set as norms in the institutions that he is jealous over, then we get into trouble. See, God created marriage. It's the first institution he created, actually, and the family. And he ordered it to be a certain way. And there's even a background reason why it had to be that way, because he said that's supposed to be a picture of Christ in the church. The husband is in the role of Christ in the church. The wife is in the role of the church with reference to him. And certainly, one of the problems in modern Christianity, too, is people don't think that the church has to obey Jesus. They can make up their own rules. They don't have to practice church discipline when Jesus commanded us to. They deny the headship of Christ, and maybe not verbally or doctrinally. They deny it in their practical behavior. And therefore, it's clear they don't believe that there's a hierarchy there. They don't believe that Jesus is the Lord and that we are to follow him and obey him. So when we're told, well, it's the marriage is like Christ in the church, well, they've already lost the idea of Christ in the church in terms of a hierarchy. And so they lose it in the church too. But the people who push for egalitarian norms in marriage, as opposed to hierarchical ones, none of their arguments are truly biblical. I mean, the only biblical argument they really give is in Galatians 3, I think it's verse 28, where Paul said there's no more Jew or Gentile, no more male or female and so forth. But of course, what he's saying there is when it comes to justification and ranking before God and so forth, all people are equal as far as God's concerned. But to say all people are equal doesn't mean they all have the same position and the same role. I mean, all people are equal because they're made in the image of God. But children, which are made in the image of God, have to submit to their parents because that's how God set things up. God said for the wife to submit to her husband. In certain institutions like slavery, which was common at the time, or even employment today, you know, for a person to submit to their supervisor or their master or whatever was assumed to be normative. Now, we don't see, society has moved on from many of those norms. We don't have slavery in modern society. We don't have kings in modern society. The existence of those institutions used to, of course, mean that everybody knew what hierarchy looked like, and to apply that to the home was, you know, very understandable. But we've gotten rid of the kings, we've gotten rid of the masters, and we don't have really hierarchy. We got radical democracy. But see, we can change those things if we want to, because God never commanded people to have kings. God never commanded societies to have slavery. That was something God did not require. But he does require marriage. And he does require marriage to look like what he made it to be. Because if we go changing it, well, we don't know what unintended consequences there may be. But we're already seeing some, because, of course, our society abandoned the biblical idea of marriage back in the 60s when they allowed for no-fault divorce. You know, God's idea of marriage is you don't get out of it just because you want to. There may be really extreme cases where divorce may be permitted, but you don't get out of it just because you're tired of your mate. And when we went to a no-fault divorce norm in the Western civilization, then we lost biblical marriage among those who aren't following the Bible. Now, those who follow the Bible still are countercultural. Those who are really Christians want to follow Christ and God's pattern, and therefore they will follow the biblical teaching on it. But those who are, you know, they'd rather do something else, well, they'll find excuses to wiggle out from under the biblical teaching. But the idea of the head not meaning authority, that's a very common feminist idea among evangelical feminists that don't, you know, they're arguing for egalitarianism. They say the word kephale, which is the Greek word for head, it means source, like the head of a river, like a source of a river. Well, they're wrong about that. They get away with it because very few people call them on it, and the people who do call them on it don't get much publicity. But no, there's been extensive studies done, lexical studies, on the word kephale, and it almost never has the meaning of head, but sometimes it is used for both ends of a river. They're called the heads of the river. And, you know, that would include the fountain where it begins and the mouth where it ends. Therefore, kephale doesn't have the specific meaning of source. The word head can be used a lot of different ways. We talk about the head of a pin or the head of a country or something. There's different kinds of heads. And the Bible is used various ways, but its main meaning is the leader, the chief. And, you know, when the Bible says that women should submit to their husbands because he's the head, well, if he's the source, I'm not the source of my wife. I may be the head of my wife by God's decree, but I'm not her source. Her parents and her grandparents, they were her source. I had nothing to do with bringing her into the world. So to say that the husband is the kephale of the wife, meaning he's the source of the wife, that'd be sheer nonsense. But David was the head of Israel, but he wasn't the source of Israel. He was the leader of Israel. The word kephale means the one who leads, the one who's in charge. And, you know, when we're told to submit to Christ because he's our head, well, you know, it's not saying he's our source, though it may be true that he's our source in a certain sense. But just because someone's your source doesn't mean that you submit to them. My grandfather could be regarded as my source, because if you go back far enough, I came from him. But I was never in a position to have to submit to him necessarily. I mean, he was not my father or my mother. So to say that one must submit because someone else is your head, it's saying nothing about being a source. It's talking about being the one in authority. And it's obvious from the way the word is used both in the Bible and in secular Greek.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Steve. It was great talking to you. Thank you.
All right, Peter. Good talking to you. God bless. Ace from Sonoma Coast. Good to hear from you again, Ace. Third time you've called. I'm glad you did.
Hey, Steve. I guess you're keeping track of my calls.
nice to
have the opportunity to sort of present my case about things. And actually, I enjoy your show and everything. It's that whistling theme that caught my attention at the very beginning. I was going to talk about abortion. But then you got those two calls before me, and I just have to say, you know, as an atheist, I'm not resentful about God. I don't believe in God. There's nothing there to be resentful about. And if I'm frustrated, or if I appear to be frustrated, and you interpret that as resentfulness, my frustration comes about because you and people like you claim to speak for what this God that you believe in wants.
But really, if there's no God, why should that be a problem? What if I said I was speaking for the Easter Bunny?
You know, that kind of ties back to abortion. And I think that the way religion approaches abortion is dishonest, and it's been used to manipulate people into voting against their best interests. And that's my main bugaboo about religion. I mean, ultimately, in that, you know, you use in rhetoric about, say late stage abortions that riles people up, and very few.
Wait.
I'm not saying you specifically. I'm saying in general.
I just state facts. Yeah. Well, there is such
a thing
in
general.
As late stage.
So you know, okay. Partial birth abortions.
Okay.
You know,
but there is such a thing.
Partial.
There is such a thing as partial.
But how many? Listen, Steve. Let's talk about it intellectually here, because you're getting kind of riled up, and you did this last time we spoke as well. And I'll agree with you that it's a life. It's got a heart that's beating. It's got its own DNA. But I just heard you say to the previous caller that the children are to submit to their mother, and when the woman is carrying something that is totally dependent on her. And especially in the initial stages of a pregnancy, a week or two after a woman realizes she's pregnant and she terminates that pregnancy early, you know, it's best for all involved if that's what she's decided to do.
Now, why do you say that? How do you know that?
Because she's the one that's alive, and she's the one that gets to make the decision about it.
There's two lives.
Sorry, Steve, that's your opinion.
Okay, well, I'm entitled to my opinion, okay? I'm entitled to have an opinion, and mine is informed. Mine is informed by the fact that everything about the zygote defines it as a life, okay? It's a life. If you say it's not a life, you're just making up statements out of thin air. Name anything else that's alive, or that, let's put it this way, that's not alive, and that grows and has DNA. You can't. So you're just making this up. You see, when you say a woman... a child is supposed to submit to their wife, their mother. You're suggesting that means the mother can kill the child. Well, I believe a 5-year-old child should submit to her mother. Should the mother be allowed to kill the 5-year-old child too? Is that your opinion?
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. What if the mother's life, what if the child's life depended on the mother to the extent the 5-year-old child, that if she died, then the child could live? In that case, should the mother die?
I don't understand the situation you're setting up here. What are you setting up?
Well, I think you're giving a special pleading to a child that's you know, a potential child that's basically a
fetus. I don't know what the parallel is. Are you talking about a woman who would die if she doesn't get an abortion?
Well, let me rephrase that thought experiment. No. A woman has a 5-year-old child, and the woman needs to die in order for that child to continue living. Is that child's life more important than the mother's?
No, they're both equally important. But what is the parallel here? I don't understand the parallel.
The parallel is that you would never say that the 5-year-old child's life is more important than the mother's. You'd never say that.
I don't think any life is more important than another life.
There is a choice that's to be made here, Steve, because it's a biological situation, and you want to imbue it with a lot more than the fact that before the baby, potential baby, goes through the whole pregnancy, it is a possibility.
No, it is a living being.
Dependent on the mother. Okay,
All of us are possibilities. You could die today, and I could die today. You might never reach age 90, and I might not either. And therefore, for me to ever be a fully mature human being is only a possibility, because I might never get there. But the stage you're at and the stage I'm at are part of the development toward total old age and eventually end of life. So is the birth of a zygote. That's part of the process. It begins there. And it ends with death. And ideally, people live to be kind of old, and then they die. But that doesn't always happen. people can die at any time. So I don't think you're making any sense here. You talked about if a baby or if a five-year-old had to die so the mother could live or something like that. What kind of situation is there like that? And I would never agree that that's parallel to a pregnancy. Now, obviously, if a tubal pregnancy occurs, there's been no, the baby hasn't implanted. I mean, it's doomed. It's going to die already. It's never going to be born. And the mother would die if it's not removed. It's, I mean, that's a very unusual situation compared to most abortions. Most abortions, women kill their babies for convenience. And you just said it's the best possibility. Well, how does anyone know that? How do we know what would happen if she kept the baby? We don't know the future. What we know is we should honor human life. And a baby is a human life. And therefore, no human being should be allowed to kill it when it's innocent. And especially when it's totally unnecessary. The only argument for abortion in most cases is for the convenience of the mother, not the life of the mother. So I'm afraid I don't follow your argument. Hey, I've got to take a break here. I appreciate your call. You're listening to The Narrow Path. We have to take a break, and we've got another half hour coming up. I'm going to go ahead and keep Ace over the break so we can talk to him a little more on the other side. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. Check it out, and I'll be back in 30 seconds.
Small is the gate and narrow is the path that leads to life. Welcome to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Steve has nothing to sell you, but everything to give you. When today's radio show is over, we invite you to study, learn, and enjoy by visiting thenarrowpath.com, where you'll find free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all The Narrow Path radio shows. We thank you for supporting the listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Remember, thenarrowpath.com.
Welcome back to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for another half hour. If you'd like to join us, you can call this number. It's 844-484-5737. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, you see things differently than the host, like our present caller does, who's named Ace, from Sonoma Coast, California. You can call in and we can talk. The number is 844. Oh, and I should say there are some lines open as I right now. The number is 844-484-5737. All right, Ace, you were on with me before the break, and now you're here again. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. Hey, I just... Before I to respond, I'd just like to say I'm sitting here looking out my back window, and I have this beautiful landscape with birds bathing in bird baths and flying around, hawks and that sort of thing. And the understanding that this miraculous world that we live in came about as a result of billions of years of natural processes is much more amazing and life-affirming to me than the idea that someone just sort of snapped it into existence. But anyway, yeah, that was just
course,
sort of an aside.
Let me just say this. Whatever view may be more or less amazing doesn't tell us a thing about what's true. You know, it's not required. It's not logically required that the truest view must be the most amazing view. But go ahead.
That's true. But the idea that there was some sort of divine inspiration behind the Bible is just foolheadedness, I think. But whatever the case, with regards to abortion, the fact is, well, what it really comes down to, and when talking to you, what it really comes down to is you want the woman to be responsible for the fact that she had sex and got pregnant.
Well, it's not my decision to make her responsible.
Well,
she has become
Wait,
Ace.
It is
we become responsible.
I'm glad you admitted that.
Right. Yeah, we become responsible by doing things, not by somebody else wanting us to be responsible. For example, someone might want me to be responsible for black slavery 200 years ago. Well, I mean, they can try to make me responsible, but I'll never be responsible because I never did it. You can only become responsible by doing things. So to define responsibility is different than to place responsibility on someone who doesn't actually bear it. If a person has sex, they always take the risk. I mean, not always. There might be someone who's past childbearing age or whatever, but But if somebody who is capable of becoming pregnant has sex, there's always the chance that they'll get pregnant. And therefore, there's a certain responsibility to be careful about that. You know, a person can do many things to prevent pregnancy. And if someone doesn't do it, they can't blame it on the baby. The baby didn't do anything wrong. So we've got, in the case of a pregnant woman, two human beings. One is on life support within the woman's womb. But it's a human being, and so is she. In fact, you yourself began this call by saying you agree that the baby's a living person. I don't know if you use the word person, but it's alive. Let's put it that way. Now, it is, of course, a human being, because if it wasn't, it would have some other kind of DNA, not human DNA. So it's a living, growing human being in the womb. The woman is simply she's the life support system for it, which is the way that you could say biology arranged for it, or we could say God arranged for it if we believe in God. But the point is, she has another human being that is dependent on her. Just like after the baby comes out, the baby is still dependent on her. If she doesn't nurse it or take care of it, it will die. So in the womb or outside of the womb, the baby is equally dependent on the mother. And to say that, you know, if she finds the baby inconvenient, she can kill it. Well, I don't believe that. I don't know of any other situation that you would probably recognize in which two human beings exist in close proximity and one finds the other one inconvenient so they can kill it. That's simply not morally acceptable in any system that I know.
I know. Isn't that weird? Isn't that weird that women are given that responsibility and they have that you know, it's like you just kind of said, it's the most important responsibility a woman has, pretty much, as to whether to terminate her pregnancy or not. And it's her decision. That's all there is to it. It's her decision.
Well, yeah.
Because
it should be the man's decision, too, the husband, because he's responsible also. Yeah, think about it. Think about it, Ace. If the baby is born, the man who impregnated her will have to pay for its upbringing, correct? So he's responsible, too. Why shouldn't he have a choice in the matter as well?
Theoretically, he will. Theoretically, okay. He'll have to pay for the upbringing. But how many men bail on women that they get?
Well, women, yeah, men can do that. And women sometimes bail on their husbands, too. It goes both ways. The point is, we're not talking about people doing bad things. We're talking about what are people responsible to do. If a man makes a woman pregnant, he's responsible, and so is she. Both of them did something together to make a baby, and they're both responsible for it. And law will hold him responsible for it if his paternity can be proven. And, yeah, he'll be responsible for the rest of its minor life. And he should be. I believe he should be. So I'm not just putting it all on the woman. I'm saying when two people do something together, and it's always a man and a woman, and they produce a baby, they're both responsible. And neither of them has the right to kill the baby. That's my position.
Okay.
And it's morally, it's a morally consistent position. You see, I think you would say it's immoral for her to kill the baby once it's been born and is nursing at her breast. If she finds it inconvenient and she just puts her hands around its neck and strangles it, I think you would consider that morally wrong. But you don't think it's wrong, 2 months earlier if she kills it.
It's true. There's this ambiguous time when a woman's pregnant that the decision rests in her hands. And it's true.
No, it's not ambiguous.
Morality, and when you elevate yourself as if you are the morally superior position, I can think of countless other examples of the Bible. In the Bible, where the best one is slavery. You just brought up slavery a few minutes ago. The Bible doesn't condemn slavery. If I wrote the Bible, the first commandment would be thou shalt not own another human being.
Yeah, but that's partly because you haven't thought it through. You have never lived at the time of slavery, especially biblical slavery. Certainly American slavery was horrendous because it involved kidnapping people from their homes and treating them as subhuman against their will. Now, in biblical times, an extremely common scenario was a person who couldn't pay his bills and couldn't support his family would sell himself into slavery because that would provide security for himself and his family. Now, if someone said, okay, we're going to outlaw slavery, then this guy who wasn't able to support his family when he was free, he's going to be back on the street again, and he doesn't have the option of having another person support him. You could, of course, institute a welfare state, but, I mean, that's another kind of dependency, you know? I don't think you know very much about historical slavery. You might know some things about what we call Atlantic slavery, which is what was practiced in here in this country, and that was horrible, absolutely horrible. And I don't know of any Christian who defends it. But slavery that was in the Bible wasn't like that. It wasn't about going to another country and kidnapping people from their families and bringing them home to make them your chattel. It was, now sometimes in times of war, prisoners of war were sometimes brought back and made slaves, which would be an exception to the general rule that many of the people in the Roman Empire had made themselves slaves on purpose and wanted to be slaves because that was financial security. It was an economic situation that worked for some people, and it would not work for them immediately to just abolish slavery. Fortunately, we don't have slavery now, not in this country, not legally. We do have, of course, sex slavery. There is human trafficking in this country. And there's legal slavery in Muslim countries and many other countries. But we fortunately, because of Christian influence, decided that the slavery that was practiced here was not at all in keeping with the biblical norms. And we abolished it so that we could recognize everybody's equality. In biblical times, slavery was often very different than anything you've heard of in this country. And maybe you would or maybe you wouldn't abolish it. If you did abolish it, if you were God, you might find that some of the people who are slaves are now homeless people who can't support their families, and they were doing pretty well before. So I'm afraid, you have to study out the Bible and slavery and all the issues that you're concerned about a little more carefully than it sounds like you have before you decide what the Bible should say or what God should say.
I think you're a little too quick to dismiss my understanding of indentured servitude and what the Bible calls slavery. But when you look at some of the instructions, I think Exodus 21, is that where it says that, you can only own a slave for a specific period of time unless you beat them to it with sin 3 days of their death, and then you can keep and they get married, and then you can keep them forever.
You're confusing quite a few different passages on different situations. The one you're thinking of.
I get a little nervous
You could keep a slave for 7 years.
Steve, can we agree on something? Can we just agree on one thing?
Maybe
you would not want to be owned as a person, right? You would not want to be owned by another person, whether you owed them money or not. You don't want to be owned by another person.
It depends on what the alternative is. It depends on what the alternative is. If starvation is the alternative, I might prefer to be owned and be comfortable. And
there
well-fed.
Is no place in any society today that slavery is acceptable. And
oh, sure it is.
The Bible,
no, sure it is. I mean, the Muslim world, you can own slaves if
you're
in a Muslim
acceptable.
Country. It's part of Islam.
You just want to dismiss Muslims. They follow the same Bible you do, basically.
No, they don't.
Same
no,
God.
They follow the Quran.
Same God.
Okay,
same
I'm afraid...
God.
Okay, I'm afraid you and I have some very different fundamental opinions about religions. Religions are not all the same. They don't all follow the same God. And the religions that are not Christian have never abolished slavery. As far as I know, the only religious people that ever stood up against slavery were Christian people. And Islam, if you lived in an Islamic country, it's still legal in many Islamic African countries. It's slavery's a practice just like it was throughout all history. It's only in nations that were influenced by Christianity that really abolished slavery. And it was because of Christian consciences from people like Wilberforce and other Christians who fought against it for a long time and finally prevailed. Listen, I've got a lot of calls, and we've been talking. Our conversation has drifted to more than one subject. But I appreciate your call. I'm sure we'll hear from you again in the future. Let's talk to Paul from Delray Oaks, California. Paul, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Good afternoon, Steve. My question is a lot less contentious than the previous caller. Anyway, it's in regard to Moses' father-in-law. In Exodus 2:18, he's called Reuel. In Exodus 3:1, he goes by Jethro. And in Judges 4:11, he's referred to as Hobab. Can you sort that out?
He's also called Raguel in some places.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he's called by all those names. Yeah, well, it's strange to us, but many
times...
Are
they all one and the same person?
Yes, I have reason to believe they are. At least Reuel and... Jethro are certainly the same person, and as far as I know, the others are too. Now, Moses had at least two father-in-laws because he married a Midianite, and Jethro, also known as Reuel, which was the father-in-law from that. We also know that he married an Ethiopian woman. Now, we don't know anything about her father's name, and it's possible that one of these other names referred to his other father-in-law, you know, the Ethiopian father-in-law. But even if all the names apply to the same man, that was not very unusual in biblical times. For example, there's one man in the New Testament who goes by the name Simon and Simeon and Peter and Cephas. These are four different names for the same man. He's called by all four names in the New Testament. And so also Matthew is also called Levi. And, you know, there was a disciple named Thaddeus who was also called Lebbeus. And he's also called Judas, not Iscariot. So there's three names for the same guy. So it was not uncommon for people to have multiple names for various reasons. One might be his name in one language, as in the case of Peter and Cephas. Peter is Greek and Cephas is Aramaic for the same name. Or it might be as with Peter and the name Simon or Simeon. Simon was his given name at birth, and Peter or Cephas is the name that Jesus gave him when he became a disciple. And so, you know, people sometimes have their names changed or added to. Sometimes they are called by names in more than one language because they live in a multilingual area or whatever. So it's just not that unusual in the Bible. And that was the case that I just gave you were in the New Testament. It's even less surprising in the Old Testament. I believe it's all the same guy. Now, again, there was another father-in-law of Moses whose name is not really told to us. It's possible that one of those names could apply to him. It's not altogether clear.
Thank you, Steve. God bless you, my friend.
All right, Paul. Thanks for your call.
Bye.
Good talking to you. All right, we'll talk next to Bob from Langley, B.C. Hi, Bob. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, thank you very much. How are you, sir?
I'm fine, thanks.
Excellent. One compliment I'd like to thank you is helping me to discern what is important and not really important as far as doctrine goes. I mean, I don't have to have an answer for every question. Sometimes it just doesn't really matter.
Yeah, on peripheral doctrines, we don't have to make up our mind if we can't.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. The other thing I was going to say, you refer to yourself as a partial preterist?
Yes.
Yes. Can you give me a percentage? I've heard it said a percentage of the Bible is how much prophecy?
Well, yeah, I've heard different claims about that. There's been some who've been very modest and said, you know, one sixth of the Bible is predictive prophecy. And I've heard others say it was more like a third. And I've heard some say it was a fourth. Obviously, there's no precise way of saying that because some passages, what are we talking about? The prophecy, like a passage of several verses long in a prophet may have one prediction in it, and the other verses in the same passage don't specify the prediction. So do you take the whole passage as a predictive passage or just the one verse? So, I mean, it's not an exact calculation, but a significant portion. The most modest percentage I've ever heard given was 1/6. Though I actually think it'd be smaller than that. I think some people are fudging a little bit in that. I've tried to figure it out.
Okay, fair enough. Now, not meaning to corner you, but in your opinion, how much of that 1/6 or of prophecy, in your opinion, has been actually, what's the word? I'm sorry.
Fulfilled?
How much is left? How about what percent is left of the prophecy? Where do you think we are?
I don't think there's very much of the prophecy in the Bible that is left to be fulfilled. For example, I don't know of much of anything in the Old Testament that remains to be fulfilled. Most of those prophecies were about the fall of Babylon and Assyria and Edom and Moab and Ammon and, you know, the Philistines. All of those are pretty much extinct groups now, and those were fulfilled in biblical times. And there's chapter after chapter after chapter of predictions about their destruction in books like Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel. So virtually all the Old Testament prophecy, I think, has been fulfilled. There may be one or two things that I'm not thinking of, but they make a very tiny, tiny percentage. Now, in the New Testament, I think that, I don't know what percentage, but I think that the books of 1st and 2nd Thessalonians contain a great deal of unfulfilled prophecy. I believe that 1 Corinthians 15 is an unfulfilled prophecy. I believe that a little bit of Revelation is not yet fulfilled, only a few chapters perhaps. A portion of the Olivet Discourse, the latter half approximately of the Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24 and the parallels in Luke and Mark, is not yet fulfilled. In other words, I believe there are prophecies that are not fulfilled which are talking about the second coming of Christ, which has not yet happened. I believe the resurrection of the dead, the second coming of Christ, the creation of the new heavens and the new earth, I think these are things that remain to be fulfilled in the future. Now, but that's really a pretty small percentage of all prophecy in the Bible. There's, I would say maybe 1% of the contents of Scripture would fall into that category.
Hmm. Okay. Well, we still have a ways to go. I thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Bob. Good talking to you. Let's see here. Mike from Temecula, California. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Dean, how's it going?
That's fine. Thanks.
First of all, I want to say you have way more patience with AIDS than I would ever have.
Oh. Well, shame on us. I mean, shame on you. Shame on me if I got more.
I was wondering, do you ever come down to Temecula area? Because I know your P.O. box is Temecula. And I was wondering, do you pastor anywhere down here?
I actually live in Temecula. And I have meetings in Temecula once a month. I have a morning men's Bible study. And and once a month, the same day, I have an evening meeting for Q&A. And they are... they're always announced at our website, thenarrowpath.com.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll also speak at other places. I mean, when I'm invited, I'll speak for special occasions besides my regular meetings.
Okay, cool. I'll make it quick so other people can ask their questions. So narrowpath.com, and it'll list when you're having your Q&A, right?
Yeah, just look at the announcements. There's a tab that says announcements. It's the first Saturday of every month, and the website is The Narrow Path. Make sure you include "the" because you won't find us if you just say narrowpath.com.
Okay, perfect. I look forward to meeting you.
All right, great, Mike. Love to meet you sometime.
Have a good one.
You too. Bye now. All right, anonymous. No, it's not anonymous. It's Reggie from Des Moines, Washington. I didn't realize there was a Des Moines, Washington. Hello, Reggie.
Hi, yeah, Des Moines is by SeaTac Airport.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah.
I've been there a lot.
Well, yeah, I'm sure you have. Well, thank you for what you do, and I hope everyone's praying for the caller who you took a lot of time with today. Was it Ace?
Yeah, he's called about 3 times now, yeah.
Okay. Well, I think he's seeking, and I think especially if he listens more than he interrupts, he's gonna learn from you, and I think it's great he's calling. However, I had a quick point for him. Is I'm in my 60s. I like to think I've led a fairly fruitful life. And my mother had spinal meningitis during her pregnancy and was advised not to continue with it. She lived for many years after, and so have I. And so, you know, doctors don't always know everything, and we need to trust in God that a living being should be respected.
Yeah, when anyone tells me that, you know, getting an abortion, that's going to be the best possible scenario, best case. I don't know how anyone could ever claim to know that. You are in an instance where the doctors advised your mother to get an abortion, and who's to say it would have been better if you hadn't been born, since you've had a good life?
Yeah. We don't know, and I don't think we're in a position to always make that decision, even with whatever current medical information we have. And second of all, with regarding have a head in the home, being the man as for the Bible. I had a circumstance in California when there were raging fires, not me personally, but here's the situation. People are exiting their home. The road is behind them now on fire, and they come to a crossroads in the road, and ahead of them there's a fire. They can go left or right. They have no idea which is going to be better because they've left not their own home but someone else's home. Now, in that circumstance, they have to have come to an understanding in advance to take advantage of that situation of who is going to make the decision. If she says right and he says left, there has to be a deciding factor, and that would be that the man is the head and responsible for that decision.
Yeah, I always wanted to ask people who are arguing for egalitarianism, how do you make the decisions in your home if you're on occasions when you're not both in agreement? I mean, do you just take turns making the decision so that it's equal? I mean, what is the better arrangement than a hierarchy?
And yeah, and a lot of my really successful married friends say that on big decisions like to buy this house or that house, there should be two yeses and one no because there are other houses. That's not a life and death. It's not a moral or ethical decision. So when it's, you know, financial things and things like that, you know, this restaurant or that restaurant, something small, you know, two yeses and the no, if there's a no, they choose something else. But in a life or death situation, in a moral ethical situation, there has to be a determinant sometimes. And, you know, it seems to have worked out for my Christian couples. I mean, they're not always happy in the short run, but in the long run, I think they are very, very happy. So thanks for all you do, Steve.
Okay. Well, thank you for your call. It's good talking to you today. All right. Let's talk to Justine from Mesa, Arizona. Justine, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thank you. Hey, I just wanted to give a quick shout out to your new book, Empire of the Risen Sun.
Uh-huh.
I just finished chapter 15, and where you go into detail about justice.
Uh-huh.
And it was so great. And I thought, gosh, I know there's a lot of other people out there who have family members who are possibly getting sucked into the whole social justice issue and
uh-huh.
maybe ignorantly so that they don't know better. And so I thought, gosh, if they could send them a copy of this, that's what I'm going to do. And just, I mean, the whole book is fantastic, but for that specific issue, it would really be helpful. And it was really great. Just thank you so much for writing that. My husband's on book two right now. So when he's done with that, I'm going to continue on to that one. So just thanks for all you do. I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate the endorsement. And, you know, a lot of people, different people have said that different chapters were their favorites, but I think the chapter on justice is the one I've heard the most, you know, praise of, that people say, oh, I need to give that to my friends. For those who don't know, my new book, Empire of the Risen Sun, book one and book two, deals at one point with the issue of justice and analyzes the subject of social justice and why it isn't the same thing as justice. In fact, why it's the opposite of justice. Someone even asked if they could just kind of copy that one chapter to give it to their friends. And I'm glad to give permission for people to do that if they want to, if they don't want to buy the whole book. I'm not a book salesman. I just want information in people's hands.
Yeah, it was really excellent. And it's just paints such a beautiful picture of God's value of justice, how it's one of his highest priorities, really, but what that really looks like through his eyes and in biblical context. You just did it so well.
Well, I appreciate that. I always appreciate when people commend my books. Thank you so much for joining us. We're out of time for the day's show and for the week. You've been listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live Monday through Friday, doing this same thing, an hour live with interacting with callers each afternoon. Now, if you want, you can catch the show on an app. We have an app, free mobile app, thenarrowpath.com. Wherever you get your apps, just download it, and you can listen to the show wherever you may be. We are listener supported. You can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593, or go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Have a great weekend, and let's talk again Monday. God bless.